First, we'll uncover some communication stories our media environment you might not otherwise have heard. On Thursday, July 22nd, the Senate Commerce Committee approved a bill that would allow hundreds more non-commercial community stations to go on the air by restoring low-power FM to levels originally set by the FCC when it created the service in 2000. Now the bill moves to the Senate floor for a full vote. If the bill is signed into law, it would reverse a law passed by Congress in late 2000, which required low-power FM stations to obey the same spacing requirements on the dial as full-power stations. As a result, most major urban areas have been unable to become home to new low-power stations, since no spaces suitable for full-power stations are left on the dial. The bill passed by the Commerce Committee would also eliminate the need for the FCC to conduct any further testing on the technical or financial impact of low-power FM. This bill was spurred on by the results of the MITRE report, which was an independent analysis of the interference impact of low-power FM stations on other stations, mandated by Congress. The MITRE report found that low-power FM stations pose no significant interference risk to full-power stations even when spaced closer together on the dial. The National Association of Broadcasters, the nation's largest commercial broadcast lobby, has vigorously opposed low-power FM and continues to claim that these 10 to 100-watt stations pose a major interference risk to full-power stations using as much as 100,000 watts of power.
On Tuesday, July 21st, more than 50 radio managers and owners gathered a meeting of the Florida Sheriff's Association in order to form a plot of strategy for taking that state's unlicensed radio broadcasters off the air. The Broward County Sheriff's Office claims to have shut down a dozen stations in the past 18 months, while an estimated three dozen remain on the air in South Florida. Sheriff's Captain Larry DeFuria told the Miami Herald, quote, "It takes ruthless local law enforcement tactics." End quote. Florida has been a hotbed of unlicensed broadcasters for the last 10 years. These stations are used primarily by immigrant populations, which don't otherwise have access to the airwaves and are not served by mainstream radio. Florida's commercial and public broadcasters have been lobbying hard for local and state authorities to do something about the number of unlicensed broadcasters. Responding to the pressure, this year the Florida legislature passed a bill that made unlicensed radio broadcasting a crime under state law. Normally, enforcement of radio licensing regulations and laws is the exclusive domain of the FCC, and Florida's law is the first of its kind. There has been speculation as to whether the FCC would seek to challenge this law based on jurisdictional issues. However, there are indicators that the FCC sees the law as some relief. The Commission's District Field Office Director in Tampa told the Sun Sentinel that, quote, "Under this new law, we don't have to be called at all," end quote. Challenges to the new law may come from outside the FCC. The American Radio Relay League, the National Association for Amateur Radio, is reportedly considering mounting legal challenge because many ham radio operators believe that Florida law is too vague and could potentially be used against legitimate amateur operators. Thanks go to DIYmedia.net for contributions to this headline.
And that's some of what's going on in our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be looking at Public Access TV in Urbana-Champaign and Democracy Now! Do stay tuned.
Kraftwerk, the robots, here on Media Geek. As reported in this week's IMC Radio News, on Monday, July 12th, the Urbana Public Television Commission, or UP, Urbana Public Television is UPTV, their commission heard a petition from a WEFT member Randall Cotton, to put Pacifica's Democracy Now! Satellite television broadcast live on UPTV. Cotton offered to pay for the satellite fees and had Urbana residents sponsor each day of programming to make the proposal as much like a public access request as possible. The commission almost made a decision to approve the request, but was later scolded by Mayor Todd Satterthwaite following an uneasy debate. Let's hear a little bit of what Todd had to say at that meeting.
What kind of precedent are we setting? Who is going to be next to ask for this kind of programming? Is it going to be the National Rifle Association wanting to put a dish on our rope and broadcasting? Is it the KKK? Is it Matt Hale and his supporters? And once you open the door, you have to welcome whoever walks through it.
So Satterthwaite there was implying that once you allow Democracy Now! On the air, then you allow for all kinds of extremist views. He later referred to Cotton's petition as quote-unquote special consideration and expressed his concern over quote-unquote bias. He later said, quote, what the commission should do is say, here, what kind of programming is out there and what kind of programming is our first choice to have on our station? I mean, you're running a TV station, and so decide amongst yourselves what's most important to have on there, end quote. So I think, you know, there's a great article about this on the UCIMC site that I encourage people to read if they really want all the details. But the issue here isn't quite free speech. Satterthwaite has sort of boiled it down to an issue of the UPTV making this a government sponsored program instead of a public access program. Whereas, like I said earlier, Randall seems to have been making every effort to make it as public access as possible.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique situation in public access TV. The way it's arranged in Champaign-Urbana is a little unusual in that it has become the domain of the city of Urbana, which runs it. In many other cities, public access is actually run by the cable company, and therefore, and in such a situation, the company has absolutely no say over what goes on. And so basically, if it's made possible, they put things on. Free Speech Television is the satellite carrier for Democracy Now!, and they are carried on public access TV stations all over the country. And frequently the arrangement is that they carry Free Speech TV whenever there aren't otherwise programs scheduled. I know in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, the cable company's public access TV carries Free Speech TV there. So the mix of the city's involvement here in Urbana gives a different flavor. And I think the distinction you're trying to draw is between the public access programming, which the city exerts no control over, which if I bring in a program and I'm a member of UPTV, they air it, right? And it's without anything. So to that extent, if you had five people who each had Democracy Now! On their home satellite and recorded and brought it in each day, they would air it without concern. This is the move forward, though, is to have there be a satellite dish at the UPTV and for them to downlink it and put it on. It's interesting. They already air programming from Annenberg, which is a foundation. It's about communications. They sponsor, say, several schools of communication at different universities, and they do programs in the First Amendment and the Free Press. And this, and the city already sponsors those programs on, and as I read in the article, I think differentiation was ever made. Like, they never said, okay, we have to go find out what else is available out there. They just decided this is good programming, we should put it on. So it seems like prior programs were not, you know, given any particular scrutiny like is being asked here for Democracy Now!. But it falls into this weird, fairly ill-defined area of politics because, according to the FCC, public access programming cannot be really censored or further regulated. People bring it in and put it on. But this, because it's a hybrid channel where it's both a city-run channel and so provides, you know, like this, the city council hearings and provides all the city-provided programming in addition to providing public access, there's this nebulous middle ground that's kind of hard to figure out what is where. And further complicating it is the nature of this Telecommunications Commission, which oversees UPTV,
right.
Which where citizens are actually appointed to the board. So it's kind of hard to actually figure out what is really true here. Obviously, the mayor of Urbana, Todd Satterthwaite, seems rather unhappy with Democracy Now! Being put on. Democracy Now! Is definitely a very much a muckraking type radio program and television program. It's aired here in WEFT, and definitely is not cut from the same cloth as mainstream radio or television programming.
What would you say about his suggestion then that this is that if a Democracy Now were to be aired on public access TV, then this would open the door for all these other nasty demons of free speech that we don't want? I mean,
it's hard to know actually. If it's true that the Public Access Television Authority, the commission there, has real no ability to say yes or no at all, then in a way, he's probably right. In a way, mm-hmm. he's right that if people wanted to sponsor on or get UPTV right. mm-hmm. to air something from the KKK, they probably could.
Or Fox News, for that matter, I suppose.
Well, it provided copyright and everything yeah, else, right? Right now, any citizen of Urbana could sponsor on a program from the KKK if they mm-hmm. so chose.
Right.
So it's really difficult to figure out what the various contingencies are within that, and it really does fall into this very strange middle ground. So it's difficult to know. But you can see that apparently, at least according to Danielle Chenoweth, who is a member of City Council, former member of the Commission, also mm-hmm. A member of the IMC, it looked as though the Commission was ready to go and vote for this. And as far as I know, the Commission votes as a majority rule. So even if the mayor and one other person disagreed, it seemed as though they had a majority to put it on. So it's a very interesting thing, and shows you how this sort of hybrid channel is a weird beast. Mm-hmm. And that is because the cable company here did not want to do a public access channel whatsoever. And there had been public access TV done at the cable company prior to being owned by Time Warner, AT&T, and then Insight. And in the negotiation of the contract, it would have said, we no longer are willing to support this, and it was the city of Urbana which came forward and said, we will support this. I will note the city of Champaign did not want to support, which is why it's now fully within Urbana city interest. I would venture to say that if it were like a bilateral commission in which it were Champaign and Urbana and it were run more independently, you'd see the politics play out much more differently. So let's go to I'll give you a chance to swap CDs there, but let's go to another issue of broadcast localism out to Monterey, California, but it also regards the national. The FCC held another in its series of local hearings on localism and broadcasting on Thursday, July 22nd in Monterey, California. Previous hearings in other cities had been filled to capacity. So to control crowds, the commission required free tickets and were issued in advance. The tactic annoyed many citizens who complained that 400 seats were completely insufficient for the only hearing to be held in a state with a population of 32 million. FCC Chairman Michael Powell was absent from this hearing due to what the commission called a scheduling conflict, making this the second localism hearing that Powell has missed. In a scene reminiscent of previous hearings held in places like Charlotte, North Carolina, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a large percentage of attendees showed up to use a scant 3 minutes each of allotted time to speak to the commission and register complaints about their local media. In one citizen's testimony to the FCC, Monterey resident India Weeks played excerpts of a Clear Channel morning program broadcast in that city called The Mikey Show. One excerpt featured the voice of what is claimed to be a 5-year-old girl telling demeaning sexual jokes about women. According to Weeks, the show originates in Dallas, Texas, and was investigated by the Dallas Police Sex Crimes Unit on suspicion on the sexual exploitation of the child telling the jokes. The station claimed the voice was actually of an adult actor, but would not cooperate with police. Weeks told the hearing that the FCC dismissed her indecency complaints over this program and another segment featuring a song promoting statutory rape. FCC Commissioner Kathleen Abernathy, who chaired the hearing, told Weeks that the complaint had been dismissed at the Media Bureau, not the full commission. However, Abernathy then went on to tell the hearing that, quote, everything I heard is completely inappropriate, rises to the level of indecency, and we have to go after them, end quote. She then promised to pursue the indecency complaint. Here's a sampling of some additional public hearing comments at Monterey, California.
Yeah, I'm Jim Burns, and I'm from Monterey, California, and I really wanted to thank Commissioner Abernathy for promising to investigate that KSJO DJ. I mean, it's weighed heavy on us for these years. And what happened was June 9th, a month ago, there was a consent decree that was signed that fined Clear Channel $1.75 million, and all the cases of indecency that had ever been filed against them were to be wiped clean from the slate and never used in relicensing hearings. And here we'd been going for 2 years with this thing, waiting for the process to work. And all we need is three commissioners. you know, to make this happen. So, we got really worried. That was during the Reagan funeral when there was a media blackout. I thought, you know, what's really going on? It was my thing was going on, you know? But the thing is that Clear Channel is the largest broadcaster of indecency in the country. I mean, they are. And the CEO of Clear Channel is Lowry Mays. And he built the presidential library for George Bush Sr. on the Lowry Mays School of Business on the Texas A&M campus. And the vice chair of Clear Channel is a man named Tom Hicks. He's vice chair. He made the president a multimillionaire by buying the Texas Rangers in 1998. Okay? So the largest broadcasters of indecency in the country are George Bush's friends.
My name is Ann Simonton, and I've been a media activist and educator for 24 years. I founded Media Watch to challenge racism, sexism, and violence in the media through education and action. Our goal is to bring about social change to improve life, especially for the disenfranchised. Local television has a history of covering our protests, marches, street theater with a snicker. We're the teaser or the joke at the end of the news hour. The overt trivialization of feminist concerns is blatant in commercial media. I personally committed civil disobedience to attract media coverage in order to begin vital discussions about the epidemic of violence against women, rape, intimate partner battering, and child sexual abuse are epidemic. While the exact connections between violence and the media is disputed, we are all surely guinea pigs in this vast commercial media experiment. Having local media access for every community member is our right. This is not a polite request. For many of us wanting to make informed choices, it can be a matter of life or death. We need a media that invests in compassion. We need to see and hear untold stories. The real life consequences of hate. Where are the stories of the 200 U.S. women soldiers who've sought assistance from rape crisis centers since the Iraq war started and were assaulted by fellow troops?
I'll address the audience because out of five commissioners, two are AWOL and two seem to agree at least in part with our grievances. We are not fooled by this facade of a democratic process. We are surrounded by police. We are relegated to police with tasers for that matter. We are relegated to the end of the night after corporate media has gone. They are gone. They have left. Independent media remains. We are forced to jump through ticketing hoops, lines, wait, and then patiently sit and wait for our turn in line to beg and plead for changes before people who do not have the power or desire to grant our wishes. This is pseudo-accountability. So go back to D.C. and make your rules. We'll continue to break them.
And that last person speaking was identified as an unlicensed radio broadcaster. So I believe he is breaking the rules right now. And we do want to send thanks to Freak Radio Santa Cruz for providing that audio from the Monterey Localism Hearing. Once again, that is our members of the public addressing the FCC and apparently not the local corporate media because they'd already left at another local hearing on localism in broadcasting held by the FCC in Monterey, California on Thursday, July 22nd. You are listening to Media Geek, the weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman, and I'm your host. Drew DiRico is the producer, and he's at the controls. In between programs, check out the Media Geek website at www.mediageek.org, where I keep it updated with news of our media environment that can't make it onto the program due to time constraints, as well as archives of the program in MP3 and the open source Ogg Vorbis format. Of course, if you have any comments, suggestions, or criticisms, send them on to me, paul@mediageek.org. So recently, there was a new zine library in Denver, Colorado, and zines are photocopied, typically, personally put together magazines, and they can cover a wide variety of topics. They started out as a fan movement. They were called fanzines and often written about science fiction literature. In the earlier part of the 20th century, they evolved into the 70s and 80s to cover punk music and have now really exploded into a phenomenon that covers just about any subject possible. And the real thing that makes a zine is that it's made by one or several people. It's very small circulation, tends not to be corporate. It's very personal, independent media. And zine libraries attempt to collect this sort of publication, which normally doesn't get protected and collected and archived for anyone. But the zine library in Denver has also had a few problems. So our own intrepid zine librarian, Mr. Adam Davis of the Independent Media Center's Zine Library. Talked to them at the LA Media Conference 1 month ago.
My name is Kelly, and I moved to Denver last year, actually, same time James did. And I publish 5 zines right now, but the best one so far has been my first, the Do As I Say, Not As I Do, Family Lessons to Unlearn.
Hi, my name is James. I publish my zines under the name Vermicious Knid. And so I've done about 50 zines in the last 6 years. I help run the Denver Zine Library.
The library is exists in a converted garage, and it has electricity, and we had a little space heater donated in the winter. So it's a cute little space. It's real cozy. All of the furniture, the shelves have been donated, and we have over 4,500 different zines right now from all over the world, different languages, and they're all broken down into different categories.
It physically opened to the public on December 6th of 2003, and the planning, as far as having meetings and physically planning it, started in August of 2003, and the idea and start talking about it between us have been going for a long time before that, just the two of us.
Who's that? It's just the two of you that run the Denver Zine Library?
We're two of the most involved members. There have been one or two other people who fluctuated in commitment and participation, but most of our volunteers don't have the same level of time commitment that we've been able to do.
How many volunteers?
I'd say maybe about 30 who've come in at one point or another. They aren't all regulars.
Why did you decide you wanted to open a zine library?
Well, James has been talking about it for years and years, and when I first was introduced to zines, I just got really excited about them. And the idea of a library also really excited me. And I'm the type of person who likes to sit down and figure out systems and cataloging and all of that kinds of stuff. So I think between James's enthusiasm for zines and my enthusiasm for computer cataloging, as fun as that sounds, we started to catalog his zines first before even doing a lot of the groundwork for the Denver Zine Library, thinking that somewhere down the line this will be useful. But we didn't know what form it would take.
Do you have a focus as far as in your collection? I know you get all donations, but do you focus on any particular type of zine or issue?
We actually include every zine that comes into our hands. Mm-hmm. So there's absolutely no censorship of what goes into the library. If someone gives it to us, it's on the shelf. Based on our personal interests and what we tend to seek out as the people who do most of the work, we have a very, very big comics collection and a very big perzine collection. And everything else. I mean, we have a lot of things, even things that don't interest us at all because they're important parts of the library, but those are our heaviest categories because they're what we like.
Right.
And some people have donated large collections. Dan Buck has donated a ton of art fiction, poetry, zines. John Porcellino of King Cat Comics donated a ton of comic zines. And then a zine library was sort of in the works for years at a local independent music store, and they donated a huge collection of music zines. So right now, a lot of our bigger sections really reflect the donors. I'd like to see some more community involvement, but right now I think this is sort of what I've envisioned.
How do you engage the community, or do you?
Well, for one thing, we're in a residential neighborhood, and when we're open, we have a big sign up saying, you know, Denver Zine Library with our hours and open, which means that people who live in the neighborhood might be walking their dog and come by, and then they come into the library and say, what's a Zine Library? I've never heard of that before, you know? So it's a way of getting people who would never come by otherwise just because it's in their neighborhood, and that's cool. And then, you know, we've had a couple of benefit events, and when we have an event, we do a lot of flyering, which brings in people who might not know about us. And more than anything, it's word of mouth. You know, we have website stuff, and we do flyering, and we've had 2 articles in the local city paper, which has been really good publicity. But more than anything, it is word of mouth for who actually comes in the doors.
So, bringing the mood down a little bit. More recently, the Denver Zine Library was shut down by the city. When was that? What happened?
Well, to start with, it has not been shut down. It is, there's never been closed for a day when it was supposed to be open. What has happened is we got a note on the door in February or March, sometime in early spring. We got a note on the door from a zoning inspector for the city saying, give me a call about the business you're running out of your shed. And we called and said, we're not running a business. And And that was the beginning of the conversation, which was an ongoing conversation for months and usually weeks in between talking. And eventually, the end result is that whether or not we're running a business where we sell things or have merchandise, we have a non-residential use on a strictly residential zoned area, and that is technically against the zoning laws. And the result of that is the inspector had to file a cease and desist order telling us to stop having a library. He invited us, we were welcome to appeal that and get an exemption or some other kind of zoned thing for us, but that the process to get that had to first be to be told to stop. But once you file an appeal, you're allowed to keep going, you know, exactly as you have been until the hearing has happened. Whereas with the cease and desist order, we had 10 days to stop or to file an appeal. Filing an appeal bought us 4 months. So we now don't have to stop at least until our court date in August. Even after that, if we lose it, we still have, I think, a month to stop from that date. And so we're still totally open. We're going. We're just working on the zoning issue.
And the other piece, the other law that we're violating is that they decided that any detached building that was converted into a residentially used structure needs to be 20 feet from the center line of the alley. Well, it's a garage, and it's where every other garage in the neighborhood is, 8 feet off the center of the alley. So now we're encroaching on 12 feet, and, you know, does that mean we're going to have to move the physically move the library more into the yard?
Which is completely impossible. I mean, it's a garage, the cement foundation, which is only a problem because they already want to give us problems. They're finding other rules that we're breaking.
Do you think that this is politically motivated?
I don't. The initial problem happened because a neighbor called and complained. So it was the city didn't seek us out. There was a neighbor who has every neighbor that we've ever talked to has been very supportive. Mm-hmm. All of our immediate neighbors we know support the space. Most of the neighborhood within the block, I think, has come in or at least talked to us. And everyone's been supportive. So somebody who has never seen the space but has seen the sign called the zoning office more than once and complained about it. And after receiving multiple complaints, they came out and inspected it, which is doing their job, and I respect that.
But the complaint is anonymous, so we're not sure what the problem is stemming from, because most of the people who come in are either on foot or on bike, so it's not a parking problem. And it might just be seeing a lot of people coming into the neighborhood that I'm not sure what about it is offending this particular neighbor.
But when we've held large events, they're usually in other spaces, exactly so that we don't cause a disruption to the neighborhood. We had one concert once, and it was this, like, an acoustic band, and it was over by 8. You know, like, we don't have create a noise issue. Like, there's nothing that we're doing that is actually a problem to the neighborhood, which is why the rest of the neighborhood supports us. But somebody is anonymously complaining. The zoning office is doing their job, and it's, you know, we have to go along with the procedure now that it started.
How has all this fiasco affected the Zine Library? You all, or the, you know, access to the library?
It's actually been really good for us because it's generated a lot of publicity.
Cool.
Inadvertently, they've helped us out a lot because we had one article in the paper already before that happened. When the guy who wrote that article heard about the zoning issue, he called us and said, you know, if you guys want a follow-up article about this, I'll write one for you. So we got a second article in the paper because of the zoning problems. That second article in the paper got us contacted by NPR, who was going to have us on Weekend Edition this summer, which would never have happened otherwise. And we've also had, you know, other zine libraries contacting us saying, how can we help you out? We know you're having this problem. Which is general, you know, people in the community who might not have heard of us if it wasn't for the problems we were having, which generated a lot more support.
Mm-hmm. And that are the folks, the volunteers behind the Denver Zine Library, and interviews by Adam Davis, who is a zine librarian at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center Library.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media and our media environment. In the meantime, you can catch up with independent media news at the Media Geek website, www.mediageek.org. There you can also download and listen to the archive editions of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format. Media Geek is produced live at the studios of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.